to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's difficult, for me at least, to imagine starting a day without my cup or cups of coffee. Like so many people, I need my daily fix of the world's most popular drug, caffeine. This week on Talking History, Eileen Dugan explores the history of caffeine with her guest, Bennett Allen Weinberg. Following that, William Lambers will offer us some historical perspective on current issues surrounding nuclear arms reduction policy in the United States. And finally, we'll offer some concluding remarks on the first anniversary of 9/11. But before we get to those subjects, while I pour myself another cup of coffee, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on September 9, 1976, Mao Zedong died at the age of 82. Mao was the founder of the People's Republic of China and one of the most prominent communist theoreticians on revolutionary struggle and guerrilla warfare. His ideas were especially influential among Third World revolutionaries. Mao was born of peasant stock in 1893. He was trained in Chinese classics, but later received a more modern education. As a young man, he observed oppressive social conditions in his country and became one of the original members of the Chinese Communist Party. He organized peasant and industrial unions for the revolutionary party, the Kuomintang, but in 1927 he broke from that group. He built his Red Army and engaged in civil war until 1941, when his forces were successful in taking over the Chinese mainland, forcing Kuomintang leader Chiang Kai-shek to retreat to the island of Formosa, today known as Taiwan. Mao became chairman of the central government of the newly established People's Republic of China, a position he held until his death in 1976.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the Marquis de Lafayette, who fought alongside George Washington during the Revolutionary War, has become the sixth person to be conferred with honorary U.S. citizenship. President George Bush bestowed the honor on Lafayette, hailing him as forever a symbol of freedom. Congress previously gave honorary citizenship to Winston Churchill, Mother Teresa, Raoul Wallenberg, and William and Hannah Penn. And according to recently released British government documents, Britain postponed knighting Charlie Chaplin for nearly 20 years because of his politics and romantic escapades. Chaplin, regarded as one of the greatest film directors and actors, was initially put forward for the honor in 1956, but did not receive it until 1975, largely because of his communist leanings and what were judged to be his questionable morals. This is Talking History.
Nikolai brewed some coffee, boiled it in a pan, drank it right on down, ridiculously strong. I pulled it out from his skull, wired to the max. He drank it all. Coffee! Oh, yeah! Coffee!
We tend to associate caffeine with coffee and to assume it originated in Arabia, when in fact the elixir of life for many of us comes in many different foods and drinks and hails from other places as well. Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, explores the history of caffeine with her guest, Bennett Allen Weinberg.
Modern society is hooked on caffeine. Whether coffee or tea, hot cocoa or cola or chocolate bars, we consume an astronomical amount of caffeinated products every year. Despite medical warnings about the dangers of too much caffeine, many still consider it an indispensable part of their lives. But how did caffeine enter our culture in the first place? How did this substance, this drug, become so popular and so accepted? With us today is Bennett Allen Weinberg, who, along with Bonnie Beeler, wrote the recent book, The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. Mr. Weinberg joins us today to talk about the history and enduring appeal of caffeine and caffeinated products. Welcome, Mr. Weinberg.
Hello, Eileen. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We tend to assume that, for example, coffee came from Arabia, tea from China. Is that true? Where did these products come from?
Well, it's kind of close to being true, but in fact, tea probably originated in northern India. And no one really knows for sure, but it certainly was an import into China, probably beginning around 6th century B.C. Coffee has somewhat of a mystery attached to it. It grows wild all across Africa. But no one really seemed to have encountered it within historical times until around the 15th century, when it suddenly surfaces in southern Arabia and the Yemen, when it was used by Sufis to sustain their devotions. But in fact, they probably encountered it just across the Red Sea in Africa and brought it back home with them.
How did these cultures, for example, the Arabs, mythologize the beginnings of coffee?
Yes, well, there are many stories about how coffee came into being. And in general, the caffeinated botanicals are associated with divine interventions. Shen Nung, the great Promethean progenitor of Chinese culture, who was supposed to have lived around 3000 BC, also supposedly was the one to discover the uses of tea as a pharmaceutical agent, as something that would restore your energies and pick up your wits, and also convey a variety of healthful benefits to you. And in the Arab world, they had similar legends about the gods intervening and supplying coffee to various people. The common legend that we hear about Kaldi, the shepherd, who was playing around in northern Africa and Ethiopia and saw his goats frisking about and realized that they had nibbled on some coffee beans, is actually a later European introduction.
How did kawa, or coffee, come to travel from northern Africa to the Middle East?
Well, as I say, no one's quite sure. It was believed, probably the best explanation is that the Arabs who were living both in the Yemen and in Eritrea encountered coffee, and it's growing naturally, and somehow stumbled upon its stimulating effects and simply brought it back with them right across the Red Sea. The mystery of it is that the Arabs actually had contact with tea centuries before they knew about coffee. And it's quite strange to think that coffee really remained hidden to the world until the 15th century, because as soon as it was encountered, within about 100 years, it had covered the entire Arab and Islamic world, and then within another 100 years, it covered the entire world. So it's just odd to think that the ancients, who knew, the ancient Greeks, for example, knew the names of the Ethiopian tribes by name, but they had no idea about coffee.
When do we begin to see coffee houses in the Arab world?
Right from the start. The Sufis were of the laity, and although they were a religious group and they got together and did their devotions nightly, they took the knowledge of coffee back home with them, and it spread rapidly through society. And almost immediately, coffee houses began to open up. They looked a lot like the coffee houses that we think of today, except that there weren't any women around. They weren't allowed in. But apart from that, they were places where people could meet with members of different classes of society, could get the news, could possibly listen to some late entertainment, and in general have a nice relaxing time and conversation. However, it should be noted that in the Arab world in those days, that was quite a revolutionary institution, and it was not approved of by any means by everyone. In those times, there was no similar place where people could meet. People didn't go out, as we're used to doing so, to restaurants and so on. And they more or less confined their entertainments to private circumstances. So this was really quite a revolutionary institution. And it was opposed both for that reason and for the reason that it was purveying what might be considered a beverage that was contrary to the Quran, that the coffee houses were repeatedly closed, repeatedly the subject of injunctions. You see, the Quran, of course, prohibits the use of intoxicating beverages. And some people noticed that the caffeine has its own little stimulating effect. They called it the markaha, their word for the caffeine high. And some of the more conservative religious people said that it must be banned for that reason alone. But they were really, in the end, unsuccessful at stopping the progress of coffee.
Well, going from coffee to the subject of tea, how did China become acquainted with tea?
Well, as I say, probably through interactions with the people in northern India. It was very early associated with various religious practices. And in fact, I should comment that the caffeinated botanicals, wherever they were encountered, seemed to have had a connection with religion. But also they were regarded as strong drugs. They were not regarded as we regard them today as comestibles. that understanding of coffee, for example, came much later. Initially, where coffee appeared in Arabia and in Europe and tea in China and so on, it was regarded as a drug, a very strong drug, and it was prized for its uses as a drug. So the Chinese first became acquainted with it as such, and it was considered to be an indispensable constituent of the elixir of life, the potion of immortality, and figured into Taoism and into its ritualistic uses into Confucianism, and later into Chan Buddhism, which finally gave rise to the Zen tea ceremony in Japan.
And how did it come to be associated with the power of emperors?
Well, in China, teas were grown. There were very rare teas cultivated and sought out. And the emperor of China, at one point, used to send people to climb mountains to harvest remote sources of tea. When they used to throw rocks up at the monkeys, who would then shake branches and the tea leaves would fall down, which they would collect and bring back to the emperor. An extremely expensive way of preparing a brew, but one that emphasized the emperor's royal status.
So we have coffee, we have tea, and let's move to Mesoamerica and talk a little bit about cacao and chocolate drinks. Was there evidence for that in early Central America?
The earliest direct physical evidence of cacao is in a bowl that is from about 600 AD, but other evidence, a little more indirect, indicates that it was first cultivated and used by a group of people called the Olmecs, who were the predecessors of the Maya. And they made cacao a very important part of their lives, and it was considered to be something that only mature people had the capacity to enjoy properly. And they grew it, and they enjoyed it, and very little is known about these people, but probably around 1000 BC, they were already cultivating the plant.
How did they value the cacao bean in, for example, the Maya and the Aztec groups?
Well, it was regarded, actually, as a kind of money, and cacao beans were prices were actually set in terms of the number of beans. The daily wages of a laborer were calculated in terms of the number of cacao beans, or the price of a fish, the price of other food items. And in fact, strange to say, perhaps, the caffeinated botanicals have often been used as currency. Coffee beans have been used that way in Egypt and in the Far East. Tea has been pressed into bricks and stamped and used as money as well. Another indication, the fact that it was used as currency is an indication of its tremendous intrinsic value, and especially a recognition of it as a drug. Because drugs, for example, cocaine today is still used as a kind of currency in certain areas, as is opium.
What role did cacao have in the religion of the Maya and the Aztecs?
It had a strong role in the Mayan religion. They made it a part of their rituals. They undertook human sacrifices. For example, they would feed cacao drinks to the people that were going to be sacrificed with the idea that their hearts would become transformed into a cacao pod, and that they would be suitable then for release during sacrifice. And it was part of their rituals and part of their priestly undertakings to drink and serve cacao. The Aztecs really made it more a part of their martial practices. It was really considered something that only soldiers who had gone through combat would have the right to enjoy. And even the members of the royal family were not supposed to use it until they had been proven in battle. So it was a very important feature of their lives. And again, as I say, it was understood as a drug. It was understood as something that affected the mind and increased the powers of thought and observation. And also, of course, it gave you a tremendous amount of energy.
Is that why Montezuma II was such a big fan of chocolate drinks?
Well, yes. It was considered a part of, as I say, their martial culture. And it was prized as an adjunct to military activity, and it would be used by them by these peoples, as well as in Africa and other places, by warriors and raiding parties to keep them going during the exertions of their enterprises.
When did Europeans finally make the acquaintance of caffeinated drinks?
Well, it was really in the 16th century that Europeans first began to encounter coffee and tea, really at about the same time as it happens, and cacao as well around the same time. The first caffeinated botanical to reach Europe was, oddly enough, was cacao, not coffee or tea. The Spanish learned its uses and began enjoying it quite a bit of time before the other European nations caught on with coffee and tea. And they tried to keep the secret to themselves, although ultimately unsuccessfully. Travelers, scientists, merchants returned from the Middle East, from the Far East, with the stories of coffee use and tea use and the coffee houses and all the medicinal benefits of these drinks. And the Europeans were very interested in trying them out for themselves.
When did the first European coffee houses open?
Again, very shortly after the discovery of the drug by the Europeans. The first coffee house in London opened up in 1650 in Oxford, and it was followed within a few years by a coffee house, the first coffee house in Oxford opened up in 1650, and it was followed in a few years by the first coffee house in London, and very quickly it became an extremely popular institution throughout England, a pattern that was followed very shortly thereafter by the other nations in Europe. And again, its story of its inception in England, I think, is quite fascinating. William Harvey, the great physician and discoverer of the circulation of the blood, was really a coffee pioneer. He attended the University of Padua in 1598, and he encountered the uses of coffee. We're not sure whether from other students in that very international place at the time or from botanists who were beginning to write about it, but he became so enamored of coffee that he arranged to have a private supply delivered to him in England, and for the rest of his life he continued to consume it. When he died, he left his stock of coffee to the members of the London College of Physicians, instructing that they drink a toast in his honor until the supply ran out. It's even said that he thought of the idea of the circulation of the blood when he had had too much coffee and felt his blood pounding in his ears. But perhaps an even more fascinating story is the fact that the Royal Society of England, which is one of the great scientific societies of the world today, began as an Oxford coffee klatch. And a few scholars, scientists, academicians, writers prevailed upon a local pharmacist to prepare and serve coffee weekly at his establishment. And they met there, and it was not in order to enjoy the flavor of coffee, which was prepared in a manner that was bitter, murky, and rather unpleasant. It was because they saw in it a psychoactive drug that would augment their mental activities. And in a way, kind of like how marijuana was used in the 60s by college professors and so on. I mean, it was thought of as an exotic drug from a foreign land. And unlike marijuana, however, caffeine really does seem to augment mental prowess. And it's just been confirmed through modern studies. And they brought their coffee tippling to London. They got a royal charter, and ever after it became the Royal Society.
Well, we only have a minute remaining, I'm afraid, but how would you describe caffeine culture today?
Caffeine culture today is more pervasive than perhaps than it's ever been in the history of the world. Over 90% of the people in the world use caffeine regularly, which is an astonishing record of consumption. And it's used in virtually every nation in the world, and it's popular in all age groups, in both sexes, in every station in society. And I think in a very important sense, it's become the defining drug of our time and one which we're having recourse to help us cope with the demands of modern life. Information intensive, scheduling demands become heavier and heavier, and there's no doubt that caffeine helps us to regulate our energies, our activities, and sharpens our mind and improves our performance. And things like the computer culture, caffeine is the cult drug of the computer world, and there's no question that it actually does improve the ability of people who are doing things like programming a computer to solve problems, to concentrate on their work, and even to input things with a keyboard more precisely and quickly.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Weinberg.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author of the recent book, The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. I speak to you tonight in a spirit of hope. 18 years ago, the advent of nuclear weapons changed the course of the world, as well as the war. Since that time, all mankind has been struggling to escape from the darkening prospect of mass destruction on Earth. In an age when both sides have come to possess enough nuclear power to destroy the human race several times over, the world of communism and the world of free choice have been caught up in a vicious...
The United States recently signed a nuclear arms reduction agreement with Russia. It's another in a series of such agreements that date back decades, centuries, if we add international agreements on all forms of armaments. Here to give us some perspective on the history of disarmament is William Lambers, the author of the book, Nuclear Weapons.
Less is more. While this adage has not always been U.S. policy when it comes to nuclear weapons, it is the theme of the Nuclear Arms Reductions Agreement signed this past May between the United States and Russia. This new agreement will shrink the strategic nuclear arsenals of both nations to between 1,700 and 2,200 weapons apiece. The premise of the agreement is simple. Fewer armaments make more peaceful and prosperous relations. And if you flip through the pages of American history, you'll see that this approach has worked before for the United States. In fact, you'll find an interesting comparison dating back nearly 200 years. Different times, different weapons, but the same theme, less is more. Naval forces on the Great Lakes played a significant role in the War of 1812. Control of the lakes was a must for any hope of victory. A massive buildup of warships on both sides played itself out in critical battles on Lake Erie and Lake Champlain. After the war had ended, naval forces from both sides still rode the waves of the lakes. After the War of 1812, John Quincy Adams was instrumental in convincing the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Castlereagh, that disarmament of the lakes was in the best interest of both countries. In 1817, the United States and Great Britain concluded the Rush-Bagot Agreement, which demilitarized the Great Lakes by ending military shipbuilding there and calling for the disarmament of existing warships. The agreement of 1817 was a significant step toward improved relations between the United States and Britain. Today, it is a relationship we take for granted, but in the early 1800s, that relationship was one of conflict and bloodshed. We can see signs of a similar relationship emerging between the two great Cold War adversaries in this past May's events. The legacy of the Cold War left nuclear weapons as one of its centerpieces. Both the United States and Russia accumulated stockpiles of more than 20,000 nuclear weapons during their power struggle. Fear of a nuclear holocaust hung over the world for almost 50 years. Today, both powers hope nuclear weapons reductions will help lead to improved relations. Those relations have been strained in recent years by the U.S. development of a missile defense system and withdrawal from the 1972 ABM Treaty. At the time of the Rush-Bagot Agreement, a statement in the London Times read, "No wiser act was ever agreed upon than to the limitation of the naval forces on the lakes." The same holds true for the United States and Russia today. There couldn't be a wiser act than to reduce nuclear weapons. Such an agreement establishes trust and peaceful intentions and lays the groundwork for further nuclear arms reductions. Just off the waters of Lake Erie, an international peace memorial stands to inculcate the lessons of international peace by arbitration and disarmament. The waters of Lake Erie are calm now, far removed from the fierce naval battles of the War of 1812. We know that the Rush-Bagot Agreement was one with long-lasting and positive implications. Only time will tell what the impact of the U.S. and Russian agreements on nuclear arms will be. We can only hope that another peace memorial will somewhere stand one day in honor of these Russian-American efforts.
You've been listening to William Lambers, author of Nuclear Weapons and a writer for the History News Service.
Thank you.
As most of you are painfully aware, this week we mark the first anniversary of 9/11, one of the most tragic moments in American history. Given the spate of programs on television and radio, and the extensive print media coverage this anniversary is receiving, we at Talking History decided to make note of it in two ways that we hope will complement these other commemorations. First, we call to your attention a special effort being made by the Library of Congress to document reactions to the September 11th tragedy for posterity. The American Folklife Center of the Library has called on folklorists across the nation to document on audio tape the thoughts and feelings expressed by citizens following the tragic events of last year. The center seeks to preserve the personal experiences and stories of average Americans. What were they doing at the time? What was their reaction? And how has it changed their lives? These recordings and supporting documentary materials will become part of the Center's Archive of Folk Culture, the largest such archive in the world. And in response to requests we've received to recommend books, which would provide some historical perspective on the events of 9/11, we have culled from a long list of good books, three that we thought we would pass along to you. Each takes a different approach to the subject and contains suggestions for further reading. First, we recommend Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia by Ahmad Rashid. Rashid provides a first-hand account of the Taliban's rise to power in the wake of the political and military presence in the region of foreign superpowers. Next, we suggest Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence by Mark Jurgensmeyer. Jurgensmeyer analyzes modern terrorism, comparing Islamic fundamentalist terrorists with other similarly violent groups. And finally, we make note of Benjamin Barber's Jihad vs. McWorld, which focuses on the interaction between global culture and reactionary fundamentalism. Again, these are only three of many good books on the subject, and the opinions expressed in these books do not necessarily reflect the opinions of anyone on this show. And on that note, we conclude another program of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed it. We are pleased that you joined us. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.